the author of Carrie, The Shining, and Cujo, and the creator of Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead, you'll scream at ghastly ghouls, cringe at weird kids, and shiver at the doings of evil doctors. Creepshow will grab you, grow on you, and give you the creeps. Creepshow, the most fun you'll ever have being scared.
Hey everybody, happy Halloween, and welcome to Spooky Season with the boys over at No Flicks Given. This is kind of becoming my favorite time of year that we do these podcast episodes, though it is grueling when it comes to the editing, because we always bite off more than we can chew, and by the time we're done with it, we have to start with our Christmas episode. So here we go. We're launching into it, but I'm joined by Matt and Peter to talk about the first of our spooky contest we're kind of putting together, where if you didn't listen to the precursor episode setting all this up, here's how the game's going to work for this Halloween season. Peter is notoriously, what's the woke word for it?
Chicken shit?
Yeah. So he scares easily. So we thought we'd make a game where Matt, Connor, and I each pick a different movie that we are competing to see which movie Peter considers the scariest without being deemed as too scary, quote unquote. That's according to Peter. It's completely frivolous metric to judge on, but kind of Price is Right rules, where we see how far we can push the needle before we've broken the gauge. And with that, we have our first pick, which was mine, because we're going in chronological order, and I picked 1982's Creepshow, which is a huge favorite in my household. But let's hear from Peter first and foremost, because he has not seen this movie. All these movies are movies he has not seen.
How did you fare, Peter?
So, I made a rubric.
Okay. Oh, yes.
Here, I'm actually going to share this with you.
I love this.
Oh, he's going to screen share his rubric? Talk dirty to me.
I reserve the right to alter this when I watch the other film.
I was going to say, yeah, that's important.
But let me run this past you guys so far. This is not a very sexy rubric. But I have five categories. I have scary, fun, FX, story, and general terror factor, which I should just rename dread. And when I say terror factor, it's like anytime like I have the urge to like look away from the screen because I can't bear the tension and like what is happening. Scary is just like general scares, like jump scares. So running you through it, fun, FX, and story are everyone's out of 10. Fun, FX, and story, obviously the higher the number, the more it is. Scary and terror, just to keep the rubric like consistent, one would be the scariest for both terror and scary, and 10 would be the least scary. So we're looking for scores out of 50. So I won't reveal to you guys listening what my score is for Creepshow yet, but Matt and Frank can see right now what it ended up being out of 50 and sort of how I feel about it. All in all, though, I had a good amount of fun. I loved sort of the framing device of this show. I tried to go in as blind as possible. I didn't know anything. So having it be told through like these mini comic book episodes, I thought was really fun. It felt Twilight Zone-y or like Are You Afraid of the Dark-ish in telling those stories, but with like a very stylized 80s bent to it. I know we're going to talk about the colors in this movie because it's I saw Frank, you and Amanda had made an Instagram post with some stills from the movie, and it is a very like celluloid movie. Like it is very like that. Like some of these stills are fantastic, especially once you get towards the end of the story and they start to really do it in the comic book frame. So all in all, a little scary, but I had a good time, I think.
Did you know it was an anthology when you turned it on?
No.
That's fun. Or maybe that's annoying. I don't know. I feel like
I had a good time with it.
Might be good to know. Okay, good.
When it shifted really quickly from the creepy little kid to the first one, I like picked up on it really
fast.
Got it.
Yeah.
It was a really cool framing device.
Okay, and I'm excited that we will have to see how these scores sort of pan out. I am still confused because you have scary as a category and terror as a category.
Yes, okay. So to me, they're two different things, and here's why. Terror is like scares that I expect or that like I anticipate. So like the very first one when the bottle like hits the grave and you see the bourbon like going into the grave and I'm like, oh shit, something's happening. And so I could feel myself like starting to turn away because I could feel the jump scare coming. That is terror. The actual jump scare or like the gore itself, that's scary.
Okay. So when the hand
does it make
pops
sense?
Out.
Yeah, it's horror versus, yeah, I think I know what you're, versus more of like a jump scare, just shock value, like sure shock value is the scare.
Yeah, it's suspense versus shock, I kind of feel like.
Yeah. So dread, oncoming dread versus like scary, spooky, yeah.
Yeah, we're all throwing around words. Before we get too far into it and get away from the start, I do want to hear Matt's history with this movie or like what he thought of it watching it this time.
Yeah, so I this is the first time I've seen it all the way through. I've actually seen Creepshow 2 more than Creepshow 1 just by virtue of I think there's a long-running theme in my family of just always ever seeing the sequels of the thing versus the actual thing itself. But
okay.
I definitely agree with Peter about like the vibrancy of the all the shots. Like I think we talked about it during our intro episode of we happened to kind of pick three very, I would say, I describe it as Technicolor movies.
Yeah.
Where like it's doing a little bit more of an otherworldly thing. And it's elevating or heightening reality. I am more lukewarm on it, I think, now watching it all the way through. There are moments of it that I do thoroughly enjoy. I don't think that the stories themselves, for the most part, do very much for me.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I like it as a concept of the anthology film and everything. And, there are individual shots moments that I really ended up enjoying.
It is fun in the anthology-ness of it because some are way better than others.
Yeah.
I think that was really interesting to see just how uneven it was because there were some that I was like really into.
Well, I want to ask about that, and I do think we'll go through all five of them. But I do for each of you, what was your favorite? Which one did you sort of gravitate towards the most of the five?
Something to Tide You Over was my favorite.
Okay, that's kind of a middle one for me, but I like that. But
I'm somewhere between that and The Crate, probably.
Love The Crate.
The Crate was
Crate
good.
Might be my favorite, although I'm oddly always drawn to, forget the name of it, but the Stephen King turning into a plant one.
Just
the lonesome death.
Yeah,
that Jordy. one freaks me out the most because he just like he's just doomed from the start. Like there's just like nothing else to do. It's just a horrible, horrible like it's almost like a Cronenberg kind of thing. But we'll go story by story. But what was each of your like? Which was the one you hated?
Not hated, but the one that literally got under my skin the most was They're Creeping Up on You.
The last one.
I think for me, it's probably The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill.
Oh, you lunkhead!
I think the problem with They're Creeping Up on You is that I think it's actually like fairly well constructed, but of all of the horror or scary concepts that I dislike watching the most, it's anything that involves bugs. Like they creep me out and stuff, and it's kind of there's an ick factor, but I don't get the fun thrill of watching a movie that centers around some type of an insect thing that I would about ghosts or something else more supernatural.
It's also felt like just kind of like a carbon copy of the Lonesome Death one, where it's like a guy by himself and the problem grows, and it's just like interesting way to do that.
But I was going to say, once we get into the story components of each one, I feel like They're Creeping Up on You tells a better story than The Lonesome Death of Jordy.
I was going to say, there's more there with They're Creeping Up on You. There is so much more of an underlying message. Whereas The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill, I just feel sad at the end. I'm like,
yeah.
it's just a depressing clip. Although Stephen King is doing some work in that.
Yeah, this is during the cocaine fuel days, isn't it?
Yeah. There's no way he remembers doing this.
He wrote several of them too.
No, I mean just acting in that.
Yeah.
Well, I think he actually wrote almost all of them, and at least two of them were based on previous short stories of his.
It's kind of messy with, like, I think you basically got all these guys together, and a lot of them did different things. I was watching some of the bonus features on the Blu-ray, and they've got Savini and a couple, and like the Key Grip and guys, right? Just talking about like how. You just, like, we got to improvise, and like you got to come up with your own crazy things to sort of do on this. And there's such a long pre-production period that they got to work through all of this stuff. And it was, I think, a lot of collaboration between some, like, one of the best creative teams ever assembled to make a horror movie, like, regardless of anything else, like having Stephen King and having George Romero and Savini all like under the same roof. It's just laser focused. But, so let's hit them story by story just to kind of touch on so we don't forget anything. So for anyone who doesn't know, Creepshow is basically like an Are You Afraid of the Dark or a Crypt Keeper. What's the
Tales from the Crypt.
Tales from the Crypt.
My very first note in my thing says this already feels like a Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Basically, it's just like it's an anthology. It's five short horror stories in a two-hour movie. It's five, but the six is like the glue.
The
framing device. So sure, I guess five and a half. But yeah, and it's told kind of in and out of a like comic book of the time, which like I know nowadays we just think of comic books as like superheroes. That's all it was. But like there was a period where that was just like a real medium of all different types of stories. Like any famous piece of literature has had sort of a comic book adaptation, where I remember when I was a kid, I had like a Three Musketeers comic book from like the 60s or something. Like it's weird how much of a genre that was. And horror was a big part of it. And especially this kind of like campy horror. So written by Stephen King, directed by George Romero with a fucking loaded cast, that's the other thing, is like the insanity of these performances in such a schlocky, campy movie is just something that you never get.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out how he dragged all these people to Pittsburgh for however long. Like, it has that movie 43 aspect of it. Is like, what dirt did George A. Romero and or Stephen King have on Ed Harris?
Well, I think it's like, well, first of all, Ed Harris was like an unknown at the time. That's crazy.
My big question was Ted Danson doing Cheers by this point?
Yes.
He must have. And Leslie Nielsen had done we'll go to the cast, but as we go story by story. But yeah, it is a loaded cast. And I think it might be the kind of thing where Romero was hot money at this time, and everyone was like, oh, great. I only have to do like 3 days. Like, I only have to be like, each actor didn't really have a huge presence with it. It's the same thing with like an Endgame, where it's like, yeah, you don't have a actually long production process. But the first story in the anthology, other than the prologue, which we can kind of like come back to, it's called Father's Day. It's a weird one, but I do think it's a pretty solid like start to understand what you're in for, as far as like a very melodramatic, we'll touch on him quick, but Peter, do you want to tell us about, Father's Day?
So here's what Father's Day is about. Three people, and here's like kind of the theme that all of these stories have that kind of got annoying to me, is they're all about terrible people.
Yeah. yeah.
Generally.
So you have these three younger folks and a mother at this house waiting for a sister who allegedly killed her father, who looked a hell of a lot like Bernie Sanders.
I'm once again asking you for my cake.
Right.
Oh, man.
Someone needs to make that meme. They're waiting for the sister who allegedly killed their father to come and like pay the respects, because she does this every Father's Day, and it's like the one time they see her. And I forget if they had like another motive besides that, if they were like after her money or something, but they basically are waiting for that, and she comes and she goes to the grave. And at first I thought it was just a dream sequence because she's loaded, drops a bottle of whiskey like on the grave, and he comes back as a zombie and basically proceeds to kill everybody. That's basically Father's Day.
Yeah. There's no explanation. There's no like curse that brings him back to life. He just like pops out.
It's a man who just wants his cake.
We all do.
Just wants his cake. A fantastic looking zombie, I will say. I really like this one. It's so funny in how it plays itself. The family who's just kind of like talking to each other, hanging out at the house, is so ridiculously awful. You have a young Ed Harris who has to be younger than us at this point. Like his second movie or something.
But I think even I had more hair than Ed Harris than still.
yeah, he's like, clinging.
You can watch that.
He's clinging.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny if you watch it, you can tell they shot it in chronological order because he has less hair by the end than he does at the beginning.
It went fast.
And the Aunt Bedelia lady is Vivica Lindfors, who is like a famous actress from way back in the day. She was in old school, like Adventures of Don Juan with Errol Flynn. She's also the old lady in Stargate, which that was bugging me. I'm like, where have I seen her?
Oh, she looked really familiar. Okay, I was trying to figure that out. All right.
Unbelievably good performance at that gravestone with like just, this is our only scene. Matt's just shrugging through this whole movie.
Well, we'll get to it.
We can be there. We can be there now.
This story, so there's a thing that I started to like, a weird underlying theme in all the stories that I started to pick up on. And
alcohol?
Cocaine probably, but they all feel like if you gave ChatGPT a writing prompt to tell a story, and it spits out all of the beats that you gave it to hit, but it doesn't include literally anything else. So it's like, I want a ghost story about a father who was murdered by his daughter coming back from the dead and taking revenge on the family. And that's literally all it does. Like, it hits every note, but it doesn't do anything that like builds any character or really any tension. Because from the moment that he comes out of the grave, you're like, okay, he's just going to kill everybody. And like that's and then one by one, everybody just like walks into a room to be killed, like almost as if they're like in an assembly line.
But I feel like it does a fun job of character despite that, where the Aunt Bedelia is just pretty standard. But like the subtle ways, like the daughter and her effeminate brother are kind of interacting, and the way she'll look, like the subtleties of sort of that relationship in the dialogue and the performances, and how like Ed Harris is not part of this family.
Yeah, and the acting, I think it works, but just in the, I mean, like you don't really get very much of anything from, to me at least, from like the dialogue. It's just a lot of it is an intonation and the way that they're saying certain things that you pick up that at least the actors are trying to build a relationship between these two characters, but ultimately it doesn't mean anything because it doesn't pay off to anything that happens in the story.
Yeah, it's not like a clever comeuppance in any way, or not like a poetic justice kind of thing.
There's no real moral thing in it, which it doesn't have to be in a movie, but like just it doesn't go anywhere.
right.
It's just the dad wakes up and then he kills someone and then he kills someone and then he kills someone and then he kills someone, the end. Like it's that very, to me, like a just like we have to hit exactly these beats and we don't have time to literally do anything else.
And doesn't actually kill them for any reason. And by the end of it, where I was like, oh, that's it. And then I was like, oh, there's still more. Like that, then we're on to the next story. And that's when I figured out, oh, it's an anthology. So this, we're going to get, you know, everything about an inch deep, and that's kind of okay. Like this to me tells you that it is such a like Friday night popcorn date movie.
Oh yeah.
Like if you wanted to make out with a scared girl, like this is what you would go do. A la 1982.
But I would say like even with the time constraints, I think that Something That Tied You Over and The Crate told stories in a much more effective way than this one.
A Crate for sure. I feel like that is just very clear on
It's the most complete. Yeah. It's the most complete.
Yeah.
Like, I thoroughly enjoyed, like, all of the visuals of it, and I couldn't stop laughing at the, where's my cake?
Yeah. And I think that's a lot of the fun is just, like, again, the popcorniness, the excitement of where you're in. And the stories themselves are not sort of, like, what you'd expect from, like a movie of this budget with these actors and whatnot. But, I do appreciate that. Yeah, at its very least, you can like stomach whatever story imperfections there are because you know, like, well, we're gonna move on in like 8 minutes.
Oh yeah, if you don't like it, it's like, yeah, that's fine because I'm gonna have the next story soon.
Anything else you want to touch on with Father's Day other than just also you start to understand that there's gonna be like some amazing framing devices using this comic book as a visual device where you go in and out of sort of panels. In a way that really wasn't, it's been done a bunch of times since then, but like this is pretty unique at the time, especially for like a non-superhero type thing.
Even for Romero, it's very dynamic because like he's a very basic, not, but just like no frills type of guy when he comes to his shot composition. But like he was going for it in this.
Yeah. And then when those colors hit, anytime like the big sort of like shock moment hits in any of these stories, like, the reds and the blues are just like cranked up to an unbelievable degree. Apparently the key grip had a background in theater. So that was like a big part of like the intensity of some of the lighting choices.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And then they sort of like the background turns into this, like almost like a abstract image from Vertigo. Like it's just like, it's a very artsy movie for something this sort of like campy.
Yeah, between date movie, also movie that you can put on mute at a bar or a party, and just like
this is one of the
Halloween themed, and like
this is one of the best like Halloween party movies on the TV.
Yeah,
I feel like we give that recommendation a lot, but like 100%, like this should be on at any bar with a TV around Halloween time.
Yeah,
because nothing is like that shocking, but everything looks really cool from across the room.
Yeah, it's an amazing looking movie. It's so masterfully lit and shot. And it's just like, it's one of those things where you think about like certain movies. I think about this with like this movie. I think about it with like Animal House or Ghostbusters, where it's like, dude, you guys were on so many fucking drugs and you somehow came out the other side with this very well-crafted thing. I don't know how you did it. You don't know how you did it, but holy shit. Okay. How's Father's Day? We'll move on to the lonesome death of Jordy Verrill, who's played by Stephen King, who I don't know of any other time he's actually, other than like a cameo, that he's played like a main character in any degree. Also, that's his son in the prologue and epilogue piece.
Oh.
Yeah, who has a fantastic writing career. He's gone on, he's written just a bunch of stuff.
Yes, he did... hold on. It's going to bug me. The Black Phone. I just watched that with Amanda. Yeah. I almost thought about picking that movie for this because I think it's right on that line. Great movie if you haven't seen it. But so Stephen King plays like the most cliched hillbilly you've ever seen. Just discovers a meteor in his backyard on his farm. It has goo in it. He just touches the goo. This is the simplest fucking story. Just touches the goo. It starts to grow like plants, like grass and stuff on his fingers or anything it touches. It just immediately turns to plants. And he'll just like, he touches his tongue with it and it goes on that. It's very like, it's like a very quickly contagious. It just spreads and spreads and spreads. And he slowly just turns into a plant and then dies
and
horribly.
Then kills himself.
And then kills himself horribly. Just shoots him. He's like a plant monster at the end, begging to be put out of his misery. And he shoots himself in the head with a shotgun, which the one thing I did say this to Amanda. I'm like, the one thing I want out of this story is after he does that, he's still alive. And he just like has one more like, oh, you lunkhead. Like he's just trapped now. But that's it. What did you guys think of this one?
It's the one that tries to be the funniest. And there are some very funny moments because he has visions when the meteor hits his backyard about selling it to
the Department of Meteors
at a college university. Yes, for $200.
He's a moron. So like, yeah.
And that's like the only funny thing in it. Other than that, it's just kind of sad. Like I said,
it's
before,
so sad.
Yeah. But by the end, he's just the other funny thing is I read a note on I think it was IMDb where it said Stephen King was directed by George A. Romero to play Jody as though he were that Wile E. Coyote falling off a cliff in perpetuity. So that's why his eyes are just massive the whole time. So I thought that was fun. Other than that, it kind of sad. Probably one of my least favorites.
Yeah,
I don't know why I like this one. So
there's
much.
Like an eldritch element to it, which I thought was kind of interesting, of just like, you know, colors out of space type of deal of like alien, unknowable thing just slowly eats its way through a farm. But like, yeah, I think, and there's a little bit of like the I've got Little Shop of Horror vibes a bit, and that's probably just the plant thing and whatever, but. Yeah, it's another one where it's like you feed a computer a writing prompt. It's like, tell me a story about a guy who discovers a meteor and then gets turned into an alien plant. And it literally hits all those beats and does nothing else. It doesn't make me care about him all that much except for the terrible things that are happening to him. And I'm always ahead of what's going on. You know very early on he's going to fail at everything he's going to do, but it doesn't necessarily do it in a way that's clever. It's like, okay, he's just gonna turn more green, and the next scene he's gonna be more green, and he'll be more green after that, and then the end. And that's kind of just what happens. And there's a couple of little interesting moments and shots, but ultimately I kind of got bored with what they were doing. I was like, okay, we can wrap it up now because it's the same thing.
Well, it's interesting too that it ends with like this like tease that the plant is now going to spread through the whole plant. Like it's the only one
it's
that
totally
has
taking
like
over
a,
the world. Yeah.
But it's the only one that does that. And it's the only one that is a full on like science fiction kind of like the world's going to end because of this storyline. One. Yeah.
It's a very 50s Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. type of deal.
Yeah.
The blob.
Blob. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, I don't know if I'd want to necessarily change anything because I get what you're saying where there's just like nothing to be done with the problem he has. Although the one thing I do like is that this always sticks with me and I always forget what movie it's from until I'm watching Creepshow. He dumps a bottle of, I think it's like rum or something.
No, it's Popov vodka in the orange juice. He makes himself a screwdriver.
Yes. Yeah. He makes himself a screwdriver. He pours a whole bottle of vodka into a pitcher of orange juice and then he takes the bottle and uses it as the stirrer.
Yep.
And I'm like, somehow this dumb idiot, that was like the most clever thing I've like, he just quickly just, I don't know why that image is stuck in my head of like using the liquor bottle to stir in the mixed drink.
Yep.
And I always forget what movie I know that from.
Cause it is very weird. It's out of nowhere too.
It's just like, weird.
There's this hint that he's like, he thinks that the alcohol is going to kill whatever's trying to take him over, I guess.
Yeah.
But he doesn't want to drink it straight. So he throws it in the army.
There's a fun version of this story where he's like a hyper, he's still like a rural bumpkin kind of guy, but he's like hyper competent where he will always try the thing that makes the most sense and then it fails. And then I think you kind of have what would sort of satisfy that itch, Matt.
Yeah. I wanted a little more because even for as short as it is, it's like you get the whole story in the first 3 minutes. And if it ended at 5 minutes after the first couple of failures, you don't necessarily gain anything by seeing the extra sequences. Except for just feeling more bad and a little bit
I think
more
you're just
bored.
Watching him. I don't know if it really I don't feel like the movie's trying to, and this might be a fault. It probably should do this, but like I don't think it's trying to connect you with him as a
Which I think it makes it a cool, like again, it's a cool visual thing, but otherwise to me it's not a fully fledged, it's not a story. You're not telling me a story. It's just like it sounds like the beginning of a writing prompt and that's it.
Yeah.
And then they move on to the next thing.
Let's move on to the next thing, which is something to tide you over, which you both seem pretty happy with. This is a great one, too.
It's so batshit.
It's a crazy one that is told so weird where you're thrown in so late into the story, but it's not about that either. Like, you're so confused. basically, like, just a quick plot synopsis is Ted Danson is just at his house and Leslie Nielsen shows up, seems to know who he is, and then proceeds to
basically repair his TV.
To repair his, I guess so. I don't. It's very confusing because he calls him by his name.
He's there to like intimidate him because Ted Danson knows who he is too. Because yeah. He doesn't want to let him in at the beginning. Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't until he opens the door. Yeah. It's weird. And he's confused. They don't make it very clear on like the background of this. But basically the idea is Ted Danson's been hooking up with Leslie Nielsen's wife. And Leslie Nielsen has found out about it. This all happens before the story starts. And Leslie Nielsen, the story is Leslie Nielsen abducting Ted Danson, bringing him to a remote beach, burying him in the sand, and then waiting for the tide to come in and drown him and kill him. But like that's not enough for him. He also does the same thing to his wife, who is hooking up with Ted Danson on a different part of the beach. And then in 1982, somehow sends live feeds of both her being drowned to a TV that Ted Danson is watching while he's being drowned.
It was a tape because he had already killed her.
My impression was it was live.
No, because he says pointed he's out recording. The VCR.
He's recording the whole thing for later because he's
specifically
also got this weird voyeur thing going.
It's not on play. Yeah. Yeah. So that's it makes way more sense if it's recorded because you tell me to do that today in 2023, I'm like that. I don't know. That's a lot of wires. I don't know how to set all that up.
In 1982 of all, he spent a lot of money and a lot of time orchestrating all of this stuff that ultimately gets washed away.
Yeah. But basically, yes. Yeah, so he kills them both. You think that's the story. And then at night, he's just chilling by himself. And then the two waterlogged corpses of the lovers come to basically drown him, to do the same thing to him. It's another zombie kind of one.
I read an alternate ending that I actually like a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of happens where he gets out of the shower, he gets assaulted by the zombies, they're coming for him. He's able to lock himself in a room and call the cops. The cops show up, and of course there's nothing there, and he tries to prove it by showing them the footage, but he ends up showing them the footage of him killing the people.
Oh.
And then it gets to like
that's
him.
Fun.
It does a jump cut to like his murder trial, and then a jump cut to him like being in the gas chamber getting ready to be executed. And he starts to hear voices, and all he keeps screaming like as they turn the gas on is, "I can hold my breath for a long time."
Yeah, that's better.
I like that better. Yeah.
I like that. The regular ending is fine, but that's a little more fun. It feels like they kind of cut it for time. But yeah, that's a nice ending. I will say, watching it this time, the dead people that come back to life, it's the exact plot of The Fog.
Oh yeah.
They just did The Fog.
It's very the Are You the Afraid of the Dark episode where the guy's haunted by all of the dead sea people who come to his house every night.
I don't remember that one.
That was the one that used to scare the shit out of me.
First of all, if we're going back to Are You Afraid of the Dark, I think that unlocks a lot of like my horror trauma to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Because I still cannot hear the theme song without getting literal goosebumps and being we got to get out of here.
Oh yeah.
The one episode though that like still freaks me out to this day is when it's the ghost in the pool.
Oh, the pool one's a lot of people's. Yeah, that's theirs. That was one of mine too.
That and the clown. When he stole the nose from the clown.
I watched the clown one recently. It's you get over the fear if you watch it now. But
I bet.
At some point, I have to revisit those because, like, it is still this thing where, you know, I'm 34 and I'm like, I don't think I need to, I need to handle that again. But yeah, that's something to tide you over. Anything else we want to touch on with that one? It's
entertaining. For some reason, I feel like it still takes too long because it's like we know what he's going to do and how he's going to get there, but it just takes way too long to get there. But I was ultimately pleased by, quote unquote, the twist at the end where he does actually get haunted and stuff. And the shot of Ted Danson's head underwater was fun, you know?
That's a fun one. That's iconic. As Yeah,
the shot of seeing the footprints in the sand coming back from the ocean. I was like, oh, that's where we're going with this. That's fun.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say too, it has to be one of the last serious Leslie Nielsen performances ever.
It's barely serious though. Like
no, but he plays.
Yeah,
it's not in the category of his other character basically.
Yeah, that's fair.
And he's still being silly, but like at no point are you necessarily like laughing with him. You're unnerved. But yeah, like we forget Leslie Nielsen was like a full-on serious actor. He's the captain of the Poseidon. It was a big deal, and that's why he was in Airplane, was because he was the guy who was in the serious versions of those movies they were spoofing, and. Yeah. Then he just ran with it and had like the most amazing back nine of a career ever. Truly.
Yeah.
I did look up Creepshow came out the exact same year that Cheers premiered.
Oh, wow.
That makes more sense that they got it. I was going to say, I always think of Cheers as like a late 70s show, but.
I mean, early 80s and late 70s have a lot of crossover. I don't know if you remember from earlier, but Ed Harris dancing.
Oh God! Can we brush over that? We have to talk about the only dancing in horror movies that can compete with it is Crispin Glover in Friday the 13th 4. If you don't know it, just Google that. Just Google Crispin Glover dancing in Friday the 13th Part 4, the final chapter, and it will live up to whatever your brain can imagine.
There's no gore. There's no scare in that sequence. No, it's so you can just completely watch it and just be weirded out by Crispin Glover.
Trust me,
dancing.
I'm sure it's a 50-second video on YouTube. But
Cheers.
Yeah,
by the
Harris,
way, sorry to jump back to Cheers. Yep. I had to look it up because I don't know. Ran from 1982 to 1993.
And then 26 episode seasons too. It's
270
nuts.
Total episodes. Insane.
All at that bar.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And honestly, I got probably a good 4 seasons into it, and like I didn't stop because I fell off of it. But like, it was still entertaining.
It's amazing.
Like, they'd already done 100 episodes, and it was still keeping me interested.
It's fantastic. And now they're rebooting Frasier, did you see? Kelsey Grammer's played that character since, what are we saying now, 82? Like, that's insane.
I have little to no interest on that, though.
No, but I mean, I Frasier is one of the most amazing sitcoms of all time. Like, that's always I always put that up there with Seinfeld and Friends as like the big three of the 90s.
Yeah.
And Frasier didn't come on though until 2 seasons in. Now that I'm looking it up, he only did 202 episodes. Yeah.
Oh.
The character shows up later, yeah.
I feel like that shows a lot of like come in, leave. It was, you know, that was more of the style back in the day. You're on a show for a bit. Okay. So let's move on to The Crate, which is probably everybody's favorite, and it's just a wild, wild story.
Yeah.
I'll hand it over to Matt to tell the plot synopsis of this one.
So it takes place at a university, and the janitor has, looking for a lost coin, found a crate stowed away under a staircase in one of the laboratory halls. There's a secondary parallel plot with two professors who clearly used to be friends, but a wedge has been driven between them because one of them is with a wife who is just human garbage.
This is Henry and Wilma Northrup.
Oh, just call me Billy. Everyone does. Oh, Dexter, you are such a child. You and Henry both, you're such children.
But at least Henry has me to take care of.
You need someone
him,
to show you the ropes, hon. You just come see me.
Buying your rent just as well.
I know
buying
all the best stores.
Believe me, town is a friggin' pain in the ass.
How'd you ever meet a man to
pick Henry?
Oh, Dexter, you are
you need someone to show you the ropes, hon.
How'd you ever meet a man to pick?
What's the matter with you two? You're not drinking?
And so Professor A gets met up with the custodian to like open up the box, and suddenly we find out, despite the fact that it's dated 1834, there's a feral monster in it that gobbles up
anyone that gets close.
It works its way through. Eventually the guy finally goes to his old professor friend, lets him know what happens, and his professor friend decides that this is a perfect opportunity to frame the monster for my wife's murder,
which is a bad murder.
Yeah, I mean, it's clever enough, I guess.
Yeah, no, the first time you watch it, it's great, but yeah, sorry. But
yeah, no, so he gets his wife murdered, and then he dumps the animal in a pond and a quarry.
And a quarry, yeah.
And then the two professors can now go off and get married and live the life that they've always wanted to live.
Playing chess. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's truly a delightful story where you have a bunch of, like, Hal Holbrook is just crushing it, where he keeps fantasizing about different ways to kill his wife, who's Adrienne Barbeau, who is crushing this horrible, like, nagging.
You're hysterical, Henry. It's just what I would have expected.
No, I don't think you'll expect this, Wilma. No, this is going to be an entirely new experience.
Truly, truly, like, you immediately are just, like, on edge whenever she's talking.
Oh, yeah. Star Trek's Adrienne Barbeau. Everybody except for Hal Holbrook was in Star Trek in this story.
That's Ted Danson.
It's nuts.
Wow.
No, in the crew.
Oh,
in the crew.
Every other member of the principal cast except for Hal Holbrook. Which is weird because Hal Holbrook used to play Mark Twain all the time, and Mark Twain appears in Star Trek, but he just happens to be played by a different actor.
Oh, that's funny. Hal Holbrook seems like he'd be, if I had to guess his Star Trek character, he'd be like the prime minister of like a planet, you know? It seems peaceful. It seems like they've got stuff figured out, but then Kirk digs a little deeper.
I don't know why they didn't just have him play Mark Twain, because it was mostly contemporary, and I was like, it's just a weird misfire. But otherwise, I enjoyed it. The story
delightful.
Had a beginning, middle, and end. I kind of cared about the characters to a degree.
I think it's the longest
catharsis.
One, too, by
I
a lot.
So, yeah.
I think it is. It feels like the most care was put into this one.
Yeah.
The one sort of confusing story aspect is that you spend the first third of the story watching Hal Holbrook just have visions of murdering his wife.
Yeah.
And I kept on waiting for that to, like, connect. So I'm sitting there just waiting. I'm like, okay.
Oh,
so
but then when it does.
Yeah. No, it is fun when it comes together. But it feels like they just included those scenes to just have like a little bit of gore to lead you up to like the big reveal of the monster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which that monster is quite the little design. You barely see it, but it's like you never even see all of it. I was thinking about this. You only see like the head mostly and then kind of an arm.
The hands.
And then there's one very like quick shot where I'm like, does it not even have legs? Like you really don't get a sense of what this thing is or why. Like there's a reason why it's or like where it came. Like there's no explanation for jack shit, and I love it. Where it's like, what was this expedition? How did they catch it? There's no explanation for why it's still perfectly alive and healthy and desperate to kill anything that comes close, but like hasn't moved for 150 years or whatever.
Yeah.
So did you notice what it says on the crate?
Julia Carpenter.
And what does it say below that?
Arctic Expedition.
Okay. What other movie came out this year?
The Thing.
Well, The Thing.
Carpenter Arctic Expedition.
Oh.
But is that just an Easter egg? That's not like,
I don't know. That's what I read into it. I haven't been able to verify it anywhere, but I thought that was really funny.
The Carpenter
little,
thing
like,
for
nod
sure.
To
yeah, the Carpenter thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah, but isn't it like the thing is set in Antarctica, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Antarctica. Yeah. But I think this says Arctic. I don't know. But either way, I think it's definitely a reference for sure. But it's also weird they'd make it Arctic and not like a jungle. Like it's like a monkey thing.
Yeah, I think maybe it was just like this idea of like it's a Wendigo or something. Essentially, it's just some type of man eater, and that's kind of all that you need to know about it.
And that it never wants to leave its crate. That,
never
that
wants
it,
to leave
like,
its crate.
Needs to stay by the crate, which is a really fun device, I think. That like tied. It will kill whatever comes within the like near the crate, but it has to stay in the crate or like near it.
Yeah, and I fully like. There's a throwaway line about like how it like has gotten comfortable with it because it's been in there for like literally 150 years. So like just that line, I'm like, oh yeah, whatever. This makes perfect sense. Why this thing would not want to like roam around and just go start running and killing. It's just like. It doesn't leave the crate. It's the weirdest little monster where it's like basically like a Sarlacc pit if you get close to it. And then there's like it is just it's so quick and brutal whenever anyone comes within reach and it just like nabs them. Like that one the student guy.
Oh, he was asking for it though.
He was like, asking for it,
ignoring
but when his face,
every. Oh yeah.
Dude, That shot was one of the ones that gets me the most. The like cheek being peeled off the side is like a great effect.
That was the one moment watching it going, oh, I don't know if Peter's gonna like this.
See, surprisingly, like I was okay with that.
Well, let's finish the stories, and then we have some scare questions for Peter.
Cool, do it.
So they're creeping up on you. I think it won't take long to go over. It's basically Clark Griswold's father-in-law is like in a technologically advanced penthouse, lives by himself.
He's a germaphobe. Yeah,
definitely a germaphobe. And then slowly, more and more cockroaches pop out and overwhelm him, and then eventually start popping out of him. I find this the least crafted horror, because like you were saying, Matt, where it's like, just put cockroaches on screen. You don't need to do a good job. Like, it's going to be creepy. Like, it's unnerving to just see them kind of like on your hand and stuff.
You could tell the way they shot it, though. Like, they were really going, like, the angles that they were getting some of it at, and when they would just, like, show up on his clothes, or, like, especially what was really unnerving is that as they were coming out of the sink and they started, like, kind of, like, going on top of themselves, like, PETA would not stand for this today, because he 100% killed a bunch of roaches on set.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You like, see it.
The tagline I had was, Rich Insane Asshole Gets a Plague of Roaches. Turns out the roaches were him all along.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
At the very end, it feels very much like the inspiration for Oogie Boogie from The Nightmare Before Christmas, because like he is literally sort of unraveled, and it turns out there are just bugs that were bursting out of him, and I still kind of want to throw up. It's still really
pretty gross,
unnerving.
Then there's a couple shots at the very end that kind of like allude to, is this in his mind? Is he just neurotic? Like, it's a little abstract. Cause they'll just like cut, and there's no roaches in the whole apartment while he's dead. Like,
until they come out of him after he's dead. Cause that's, I think the full end is they fill the panic room.
Yeah. But they're not in the other room anymore. Like, it's weird. And then there's a couple shots with his nun on the console. Like, it's trying to be this sort of like coin flip of like, I think it's trying to do both a little bit. One thing I do like about it is the fucking weird way first of all, he's the only actor in it, really. Like, everyone else is just like a voice on a phone. The way every other voice plays it is so strange and eerie, where it's like how he's hearing them. It's not a real performance. Even the guy who comes to the door is like,
oh, that's the weirdest one. Yeah.
It's so creepy. Like, and even at the end, they're playing it as if everyone else is in on the fact that he's going to die and are thrilled by it. And he just gets eaten by roaches. It's.
Yeah. And that's it.
Fairly creepy.
But he had it coming. So like.
Yeah. He's cool. Awful. Terrible person. It's a little Ebenezer Scroogey. I kept getting like specifically Scrooged vibes from the 80s-ness of the tech, I guess, was really like doing it too, but
yeah,
it's kind of an interesting one.
It's like if Elon Musk was a massive germaphobe and was trying to have like the most modern technology in 1982,
sure,
that you could fit into a penthouse in New York City, which it was really interesting that this is the only thing that has a definitive time and place.
Yes,
this is 1982 in New York City. That was really interesting, and I felt like helped add to what I appreciated about it in that it was effectively like this asshole is rotten, and he's so rotten that he's going to drive himself into a psychosis and ultimately like reveal that he is just the thing that he thinks he hates most, which is all of his bigotry and racism and classism and all of the things that make him a terrible person that you get to see throughout the whole episode. I actually kind of enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the performance of E.G. Marshall for just like losing his mind.
Oh yeah.
He's bit good. By bit. He was
again,
really fun.
Crazy. They got him. I will say, I don't like that this is the last one. I think switch this in the crate.
Agreed.
I think
agreed.
That's much better. It's such a weird one to end on. You know, it feels like it could be the second one. I don't know. It's just,
I would go Father's Day, Something to Tide You Over. If I had to like redo the order, it'd be Father's Day. Actually, it might do Father's Day, They're Creeping on You, The Lonesome Death of Jody Verrill, something to tide you over the crate, I think is how
I wouldn't do Creeping on You and Lonesome Death next to each other, because they're both like isolated guy stories. You gotta put something between them. But anyway, we're splitting meteor hairs. Peter.
Well, and then the epilogue,
the son gets a voodoo doll. There's this other story, stabs his dad
in the neck repeatedly.
Yes.
The end.
Did anyone recognize the garbage men?
Tom Savini.
Yep. Tom Savini. It's one of them, and the other one's the key grip. Peter, what got you the most? What was the closest you came to walking out of the room?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the closest would be, I don't like sort of disgusting humor. So when in They're Creeping Up on You, there's a scene where he's like blending cereal or something, and he finds out that he's been eating roaches, and that was a moment where I was like, bleh, bleh, and that was like, I don't know if I'm gonna get through this one. So that was honestly the closest in terms of just like, I actually might turn this off. The first scare that got me though was the hand coming out of the grave in Father's Day. I had that marked as sort of my first jump scare, and I was like, fuck, this is just going to be a series of jump scares, and I started to sort of anticipate it, and that added to my dread factor.
Real quick aside, because I meant to say this earlier, but speaking of, first of all, the cockroach thing, again, like, I fault the movie for that being an effective thing, because like, you're using cockroaches. It's fucking effective. Like, that's not a skill to just do something that I'm already walking into the movie, like doing all the legwork of it. But I was showing Amanda Arachnophobia the other night. She'd never seen it. It's a fun little spider movie. It's directed by Frank Marshall. It's perfectly fine. Very 90s. But while we're watching it, we're sitting on the floor because we were like eating dinner at the coffee table, and we have a weird coffee table that's low. So we like sometimes we'll just like sit Japanese style. And while we're watching the movie, a fucking cockroach comes crawling out, and we haven't seen one in our apartment in years, comes crawling out straight towards me on the carpet, and I lose my shit watching like the spider movie while this thing is on the floor. My heart was racing. Flushed down the toilet, and then kept flushing the toilet every half hour for the next 3 days.
It is literally every New Yorker's worst nightmare, which is why it being set in New York is just also sort of a cherry on top.
Oh, but yeah. The cockroaches really don't bug me too much when I'm like ready for it. It was just, if had I not been watching a bug movie, I'd be fine. Like cockroaches and mice don't really do much. Like, it's really like snakes is the thing that gets me the most of like creepy crawlers, I guess. I don't know.
Insert snakes. Why is it always snakes?
I hate snakes, Doc! I hate them! Come on, show a little backbone, will ya?
So the bugs got you, the hand scare. That's a fun... I love a good jump scare that you immediately laugh that it got you afterwards.
Yes, exactly.
Fun movie.
But it is such a barometer for expectation for the rest of everything, right?
Yeah. I think that's what that first story does well, is it's sort of like... paints with broad strokes, but it gives you a pretty good catch of like the range of where you're going to be. I can't think of another story that would do as good a job being the first one other than The Crate, but that would just be shooting your wad. So
yeah,
I don't know. It's fun. It's not too scary, right?
No, it wasn't that scary. Like on a scale of 1 to 10. So in my rubric, I gave it a 6, where 1 is the scariest and 10 is the least scary. So think of it as like a traditional 4 on like a 1 to 10 scale.
I don't get it, but I'm going to just trust that the math works out and we'll keep going.
Think of it as like if you had to do it traditionally, because I'm just doing it for the math. So
yes.
No, I'm sure it works. I just had a big math day at work, so I'm not going to.
How's that for you?
A big math day. Okay, cool.
Yeah, you're if the movie is too scary, it's going to be punished by getting fewer points awarded.
Correct.
To it. Yeah, that makes sense. I get it.
Okay, so it's not. Yeah, so I was thinking more of a pass fail, and you're giving it more of a gradient. It's interesting. Okay,
I'm very curious to see how the rest of the movies pan out in that fashion.
I don't know yours. I don't know the gate, but I do. I feel like I've got a leg up on Return of the Living Dead, unless a specific thing in that movie. Puts Peter over the edge. I don't know.
We'll see. So let me run through the rest of my scores really quick, just to give you sort of a final score. So for fun, I gave it a 6 out of 10. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fun. FX, I gave it 7 out of 10, sort of adjusting for 1982 because I thought there were some really fun effects. I thought the zombie was really good. I
How
thought
do you not
the creature...
give it a 10 adjusting for 1982? This is like that, top of its game.
Actually, that's probably fair. And like I said, I reserve
fault
the right at the end of
one
this.
One thing
to...
in it. I can't think of a... like it's.
I wouldn't fault it, but I think there are other movies of the 80s, some that we're going to be watching this month, that deserve a higher score.
Are you thinking of The Gate? Because I don't know The Gate. I'm excited.
No,
awesome.
There's
you're...
stuff in Return of the Living Dead that I feel like is...
Oh, yeah. I mean, we picked amazing films. This is going to be great.
Way to be humble.
Story, I gave a 7.5 just because I liked the framing device. And I was trying to come up with sort of a median number plus framing device for the stories. Because like I said, some stories, not great. But the framing device is carrying a lot of the number there. And then my last score was Dread Factor. Again, 1 being the dreadest, 10 being the calmest, and I gave that a 5. Mm. So again, that'd be a 5 and a 1 to 10 anyway. With a total score out of 50 of 31.5.
Okay.
31.5 points out of 50.
Okay. I'm curious what the rest of the movies will do. Will you potentially adjust this scoring depending on like...
Yes.
Okay, all right. So we'll kind of see where we land. Okay.
Yeah, I reserve the right by the last episode. I will have sort of a final score as I reflect on everything and maybe try and rewatch bits and pieces here and there to like confirm my my biases. But yeah, we'll get a more true score as things go on.
Okay. Well, at the very least, I'm excited to have watched this with you guys. It's one of my favorite Halloween movies to throw on. Gets me in the Halloween season. All every year.
I think it's a good tone setter.
I appreciate the exposure, actually, because this does feel like one of those movies that comes up a lot as people's favorite Halloween movie or like one of them and a classic. So I appreciate sort of being forced to do something that I would not do otherwise.
It's also I find it a fun one to keep rewatching. Like I think it's nourishing almost knowing where the stories are going to go and just kind of like letting them wash over you a bit. And I will say, Peter, there is a Creepshow 2.
I did see that. And like I think there was a remake in 2019 and somebody tried to do a TV show.
I haven't seen that. I think I turned the second one off. We were talking before you came on, Mike, but I do need to finish that. I'm sure it's got its moments.
I think I might like it better than this one only by virtue of the fact that I think it they only did 3 stories and they're more fully baked.
Okay. I'll give it a try. And then
there was a Creepshow 3 in 2006.
Oh.
Yeah,
weird.
But to my understanding it had nothing to do with either Romero or Stephen King.
No. I will say if you like this and you want something kind of similar that I don't think is as good, but it's fun, is also there's Body Bags, which has a performance by John Carpenter, the only acting performance I can think of him with, and it's worth it for him alone because he brings it. He plays like a mortician, works in a morgue,
coroner
kind of guy.
He's a coroner.
He's like they were trying to do a run on the kind of Crypt Keeper character.
Because John Carpenter just looks like the Crypt Keeper, so.
He does, especially in that. But yeah, it's a fun little one. I think Mark Hamill's in that too. That was around the time they were working together a lot from Village of the Damned or the Children of the Damned. Someone was damned. But yeah, delightful. I'm really excited for Return of the Living Dead, and I'm excited to finally see The Gate. I don't know anything about it, and I've been avoiding even looking at the plot, so.
It's going to be a fun month.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot for me. This is a...
I think...
We're still out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, but
I think
it'll be fine. The other two are, I think, tonally are still kind of in this ballpark, so I think if you could handle this, I think you'll be perfectly fine for the other two.
Okay.
Yeah,
I feel pretty good about that.
I feel pretty good about Return of the Living Dead. That's the most I'll say. But that's also like just one of my favorite comedies. It's so good.
Don't blow that now.
I got nothing. I got no outro.
I was trying to think of a good punny Crypt Keeper thing to say, but I couldn't think of it fast enough.
We're too youthful and vibrant to be a Crypt Keeper. So
we I mean, just
give it two more years.
Scare you later.